text me at 1-800-465-8770 if you want to weigh in on any of the conversations we've had so far this afternoon, or if you hear anything that sparks your interest and you want to weigh in, 1-800-465-8770. There's a lot of news happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending.
What's trending? Let's get political.
It sometimes feels like the Democrats are going out of their way to make sure that we all know that the impeachment sham is just that, a sham. We had yet another day of impeachment testimony, no fact witnesses whatsoever. We had attorneys that are paid for by the Democrats and one from the Republican side to provide their analysis. With all due respect to both of them, who I'm sure are great lawyers, I don't care what they have to say about this, including the Republican. He made some good points, Steve Castor, but I don't care what he has to say on this. He's not a witness. He's not an expert. He's someone who's paid by the Republicans. Likewise, I don't really care what the Democrat has to say. John Goldman, I don't care. Or Daniel Goldman, excuse me. Good for you. You have a position that you hold despite all of your biases. I'm supposing I expect you to have these crazy positions. Okay, fine. Now what? No new information today. None whatsoever. Literally none. What we did have was an amazing visual of how much of a sham this is, how much of a conflict of interest this is, that I have to assume that if you're just a casual viewer of what happened, even you would be able to find out that this doesn't sound right, because it's not. We had a Democratic witness also serve as the lawyer for the Democrats on the committee, who then also told Jerry Nadler how to respond to Republican objections. No one sees that as problematic. Folks on the left who want to see this president impeached, none of you have any concerns whatsoever. This is, in the words of Louie Gohmert, the congressman from Texas, a kangaroo court.
I've been in some kangaroo hearings in courts, not my own when I was there, but I have been mistreated in hearings before. But I have never seen anything like this where we don't allow the fact witnesses to come in here. We have the lawyers come in and tell us what we're supposed to know about those witnesses and about their testimony and about their impression and what the law is. This is outrageous. My friend Jim Sensenbrenner said in 41 years, he's never seen anything like what we have going on here to try to oust a sitting president.
They're doing this because they don't like the president, and that's why they're not following any kind of rule book. None. When Republicans ask about rules, they're told by Jerry Nadler, now's not the time to ask about rules. Well, can you tell me the rules as to when it allows me to ask about rules? No, we're not going to be able to do it. You're going to have to do that later. And part of the reason why it's failing so miserably, I think, with the American people is what's happening on the side of the Democrats is inauthentic. They're trying to give the appearance, they're trying very hard to give the appearance of fairness, which is why essentially it's failed, because it's not fair. You can't put lipstick on a pig and have us not see the actual pig. This was, in the words of Doug Collins, a focus group impeachment, because they were focus grouping every aspect of this.
I tell you, this may be, though, become known as the focus group impeachment, because we don't have a crime, we don't have anything we can actually pin, and nobody understands really what the majority is trying to do, except that interfere and basically make sure that they believe the president can't win next year if he's impeached. The focus group impeachment takes words and then takes them to people and say, how can we explain this better? Because we don't have the facts to match it. A focus group impeachment says, you know, we really aren't working with good facts, but we need a good PR move. That's why we're here today.
I don't even know if this is a good PR move, because what was very clear with the Democratic witness and Daniel Goldman, he's got a lot of conflicts. A lot of conflicts, and he's not very consistent. Here again is Doug Collins, absolutely ripping Dan Goldman.
Mr. Goldman, we're used to committees and people and witnesses coming, taking gratuitous shots at people they don't like. And earlier today, in your testimony, you made a comment that really goes with an interesting thing, and I'll even go back to the chairman questioning motive. When your testimony, you said, as you were discussing Mr. Sondland, you made a very snide comment, your facial expression showed, that he was a $1 million donor to the president. The implication being he either got his job because he bought it, or his implication was he was loyal to the president and say anything about it.
Be very careful about how you throw around dollars in giving, because you and Mr. Burke are real heavy donors to the Democratic Party. And I'm not going to say it questions your motives or your position here today, but we need to make sure that this thing is already blown out of proportion. We're already not answering questions, and you are here without a pen because your chairman will not testify. That says all we need to hear.
By the way, and I'll let him finish, without a pen, that's a reference to Adam Schiff, who has chosen not to come in and sit under oath and answer questions because he's not able to answer questions without lying. He's already lied to the American people and got caught multiple times, including about having no contact whatsoever with the whistleblower. I don't know who the whistleblower is. He said, oh, we've had no contact. My office had no contact. And then, of course, 2 weeks later, we find out, actually, yes, you did 100%. Your office had contact with the whistleblower. That's why he doesn't want to go up there and sit. It's his report. His name is on it. Daniel Goldman's name is not on it. This report coming from the House Intelligence Committee. Adam Schiff's name is on it. Continue.
He don't even stand behind his own report, and he sends you. I hope it works out for you. I'm done. At this point, I turn it over to Ashley.
Could I respond? Are you trying to say that I... what are you trying to say? What is the implication here?
You don't know the implications? Seriously, you don't know? You're asking for Matt Gaetz to get involved. He's going to yell at you. Don't do it. Don't do it.
But by the way,
he's doing it.
I didn't give anything close to $1 million remotely. Uh-oh. So I don't know.
The implication is we want Schiff in that chair, not you. The implication is the person that wrote the report is the person that should come and present it. And you weren't elected by anybody. And you're here giving this testimony in place of the chairman. I hope that clears up the implication.
The gentleman does not have the time. And the gentleman has been warned before. He cannot simply yell out and disrupt the committee.
I think that's what he just did.
That's exactly what just happened.
So weird. I guess you don't get people listening to you if they don't have respect for you, and they don't have respect for you because you don't have respect for the process. As much as I don't care what Steve Castor has to say in a witness testimony, because he's a Republican lawyer, so he's getting paid by the people he's essentially being asked questions of, he made the point perfectly. What is this all about? Hatred of Donald Trump.
To impeach a president who 63 million people voted for over 8 lines in a call transcript is baloney.
Baloney.
Democrats seek to impeach President Trump not because they have evidence of high crimes or misdemeanors, but because they disagree with his policies. This impeachment inquiry is not the organic outgrowth of serious misconduct.
Not at all. This is being scared that they don't have a Democrat on their side that's going to be able to defeat President Trump when he runs for re-election, when the vote actually comes in. Right now, it's pretty clear there's no one on that debate stage for the Democrats who have a shot at defeating this president, not when the economy is doing as well as it's doing. And one of the weird consequences, unintended, of all of this is they're helping the president ensure he gets re-elected. Kayleigh McEnany from the Trump team said this on Fox News.
There's nothing that has been a bigger motivator for our base and for our financial contributions than this impeachment sham, this coup against a sitting president. The day Nancy Pelosi announced in the 3 days that followed, we raised more than Joe Biden did in 3 months. So we'll have our fourth quarter numbers out near the end of the year. But safe to say, it is fueling our coffers.
So not only are they making a whole bunch of money, record amounts of money from people who are out there listening right now, listening in Squim or Sumner or Issaquah or Clinton. Like, you guys are donating. We're not talking about millionaires and billionaires. You guys are donating because you truly understand what's at stake if we are to allow Democrats to do this to a sitting president, impeach someone simply because they don't like his politics. And that's why he's going to win re-election. Talk about an unintended consequence of impeachment. Not only not being successful in removing someone from office, but ensuring that he stays another 4 years. Way to go, Democrats. 1-800-465-877 if you want to send me a text message. 1-800-465-877. Text the keyword RANTZ, R-A-N-T-Z, to the number 1-800-465-8770. And I'll send you a link to my brand new blog about Gonzaga University and a Christmas tree controversy over sustainability. Text the keyword RANTZ, R-A-N-T-Z, to the number 1-800-465-8770, and I'll go ahead and send you a link to my story. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? The sports ball.
So it was the Seahawks game that no one saw coming, an absolute horrific result for the Seahawks as they went into L.A., hoping to win, hoping to get on top in the conference. Didn't actually work so well. Here is producer Peyton's two-minute drill.
Start your watches and off we go because it's time for the two-minute drill.
But the ball is picked off by Hill. He tries to run out of the end zone, but he's touched by Lockett in the end zone. And it's going to go
out.
The Rams.
That was a rough Seahawk game to watch last night. 3 hours or however long it was that every Seahawk fan wanted to pull out their hair or gouge out their eyes. That was rough. Silver linings, Quandre Diggs had two interceptions. Outside of that, not much. We got outcoached by Sean McVay. Jared Goff was able to roll out of the pocket and look like Russell Wilson all day long, being able to find Higbee, being able to find Robert Woods, and look immaculate, where the Rams are now starting to build things and look like a playoff type of team. And we're going to see three teams come out of the NFC West make the playoffs, two of them being wild cards, because I think that the Rams can catch the Vikings in every
sense. They played better than us tonight. We didn't play our best game. There's opportunities out there that we had, and they just didn't go our way. There's a lot of season left. Where we're trying to go, a lot more season left, a lot more things to do. Everything's still out in front of us. You got to play one game at a time.
Here's where it got a little bit worse. The 49ers went on the road. They were able to get a win against the New Orleans Saints, meaning they took the number one spot back in the NFC West, as well as the number one spot away from the Saints in the NFC. They right now control themselves as hosting all of their playoff games at home, and that's huge. But the Seahawks still have the Niners on the schedule. That's great news. Next week, the Hawks go and play Carolina, who have just fired their head coach, and they're playing their backup quarterback. So let's hope the Hawks can get a little bit of momentum before coming back home for the final 2 weeks against Arizona and the San Francisco 49ers.
If it is the case where this is somewhat of a, a jerk your neck around, then it's good. We'll take care of business. We're going to put this game behind us and get rolling, get ready to give Carolina to get a win. And that's the only thing that's important. No matter what happened in this game, we had to do that anyway. So we haven't changed, and we got to finish this thing off right.
That's all the time I have for the Jason Rant Show. I'm producer Peyton.
Again, just putting this on the record, let the record show that I said it was bad, bad mojo to put out there opening up all the playoff tickets for the Seahawks before they actually clinch the spot.
Yeah, no big deal.
I'm just throwing that out there. Now, again, looking at paper, it would suggest that the Seahawks are in a really good spot. They're going to take on two teams that are awful in Charlotte and Arizona. Then they take on the 49ers. 49ers have a slightly more difficult schedule ahead, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, at least one game in the Rams that they're taking on before they play the Seahawks. I do look forward to that end of season game.
No, that'll be really good. But the Seahawks can even clinch playoffs with a loss, from the Vikings.
Mm-hmm.
So, they have a mighty big cushion right now.
I will say this earlier, and I said it earlier with Bob Stelton from our sister station. Over the weekend, I was saying, I don't like this whole idea of rooting for the 49ers over the Saints. The Saints should win. We should want the Saints to win so that the record for the 49ers isn't good. We would be number one right now, right? Or we would have the same exact record as the 49ers right now.
Yeah, if we would have won. If we would have taken care of our business.
Oh, okay, stop that. Is that like a sports radio thing, taking care of business?
Yeah, take care of your own business. Take care of business before you worry about, other people's business.
Well, I'm saying I would like a little bit of a help in taking care of our own business. The Seahawks choked. Bam.
Good job. They did.
Yeah, they did. But they'll win next week. Sure. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Celebrity news.
So some tragic news over the weekend due to the death of a rapper that I'm going to guess that 99.9% of you who are older than 21 probably have not actually heard of this rapper. But if you've got kids who are teenagers or college-age students, chances are they know who Juice WRLD is. Juice WRLD died over the weekend at Chicago's Midway Airport, just 21 years old. His real name, Jared Higgins. Here's one of the songs that So the cause of death is unknown. He did have some kind of cardiac arrest at a private hangar. So TMZ is reporting that he allegedly popped some pills before his death. They're not sure what the pills actually are, if that happened. They were told by one of his friends, apparently telling the cops, that he had a Percocet problem. He has admitted in the past to abusing codeine cough syrup, which was found in his possession when cops searched through the plane and the hangar, they found a lot of weed, 41 vacuum-sealed bags of marijuana, 6 bottles of prescription codeine cough syrup, 2 9mm pistols, a 40-caliber pistol, a high-capacity ammo magazine, and metal-piercing bullets, according to law enforcement sources. That taken from the Chicago Tribune. So the reason why we want to talk about this story is not because you know who he is, and I'm willing to bet there are a lot of people who just don't care. It's just to you, it's just some other rap star who ended up going down the wrong path, and he got what he deserved. That's an awful take, with all due respect. This is someone that you should be aware of, in that your kids know who he is, right? And this is a good story, not just about making sure you're talking to your kids about prescription drug abuse and everything else. We've already been having those conversations. I don't know how much we've had it beyond just having it as a society as it relates to the opioid epidemic here. But this is a good opportunity to have a conversation with your kids about how even people who are so-called privileged, you know, celebrities, musicians, even they can go down the wrong path. These are people that your kids look up to. Whether or not you want them to, it is a fact. There are a lot of kids who looked up to Juice WRLD. And they should have. Outside of this abuse that he allegedly had, he was an incredibly talented musician. He has a really interesting backstory. He should not be where he is today or was today because of his backstory. And yet he overcame because he had a talent that was embraced, that was nurtured, that put him on this path. But obviously he still had some demons. Whatever ends up happening in all of this, know that your kids are following this story and you have to be prepared to have a meaningful conversation with them. Otherwise, all they're going to know is this really cool guy that I listened to his music of, he died. Now, maybe some of this was a self-fulfilling prophecy because you were a fan of his.
I like Juice WRLD.
Yeah, Juice WRLD is a talent. I can't say I love his music. It's not necessarily the genre I like, but that song that we just played was with Ellie Goulding, who I do like, and that was a really good song. But he's got a whole bunch of songs that apparently sort of said to the world, hey, I might not be doing this for so long. He had a song called Legends that is quoted as saying, what's the 27 Club? We ain't making it past 21. This time it was so unexpected. Last time it was the drugs he was lacing. All legends fall in a making. Sorry, truth. Dying young. Demon youth. What's the 27 Club of? We're making it past 21. Yeah, I know that in retrospect, obviously, you listen to something like that and it's maybe a red flag, but he did die of a cardiac issue. He didn't kill himself.
Correct. But, I mean, you know, the 27 Club has so much speculation around it. And he, it
27 it, Club meaning a lot of musicians don't last past 27 without correct. Dying from some kind of personal tragedy.
Correct. And now he falls into that group, although, you know, he kind of calls it out at being 21.
He also compared himself to John Lennon, who died on the same day about 40 years apart. So a lot of just eerie red flags, lyrically at least. 1-800-465-8770. Again, if you've got kids who are aged, you know, 12 to 24, just do some research on this story so you can have a you should be having a conversation with your kids about this. 1-800-465-8770. Back to the Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. There's long been an argument between gay rights and religious rights, and without some kind of compromise, one group will undoubtedly lose some of their rights. It appears now, at least according to my next guest, that we've got a compromise fix. Brad Palumbo is the deputy contributors editor over at the Washington Examiner. His brand new column, which you should read right now, WashingtonExaminer.com, says a new bill from Republican Representative Chris Stewart strikes the perfect balance for both sides. Brad Palumbo joins me now. Brad, thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So before we jump into this bill, it's called the Fairness for All Bill. Tell us how we got to the moment where we're at right now, where it is essentially gay rights advocates versus religious liberty proponents.
Absolutely. So a couple things have brought us to where we are right now. first and foremost is that the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the only current federal anti-discrimination law binding all 50 states, does not protect people on the basis of sexuality or gender identity. That's understandable. You know, it was written in 1960, but obviously society has come a long way in how it views gay people and transgender people, and so there's been a real push to add those protections. Then the question is, because we've also seen Supreme Court cases like Masterpiece Cake Shop, where you have the Christian baker harassed by gay couples who want him to service their wedding, where do you balance adding those rights with the rights to freedom of religion proposed and enshrined in the First Amendment by our founding fathers? That I think all conservatives agree are also important. So it's we've had this militant left-wing activist campaign that has wanted to basically crush the religious liberty and put all LGBT rights first and foremost, and that's manifested itself in a piece of legislation passed by House Democrats called the Equality Act. Now, the Equality Act is it's kind of misleadingly named. It's actually basically a radical left-wing bill that would crush religious liberty. It has no religious exceptions, but it would update the Civil Rights Act to have new protections. Now, obviously, conservatives, even like myself, gay conservatives, do not support that approach. But we also don't want to just do nothing and leave it so that in dozens of states, you can be fired by McDonald's for being gay and you'll have no recourse under federal law. So this new bill from Congressman Chris Stewart of Utah is an attempt to thread the needle with a compromise legislation that protects religious liberty and LGBT rights.
And part of the way he does that is how he defines public accommodation. It is very narrowly tailored to put in perspective something that you wrote in your piece, you know, that these rules would not apply to small businesses like this religious baker.
Yeah, so I've always put it like this. I do not believe that in the United States of America, a corporation like McDonald's that's secular, that's huge, should just be able to fire someone for being gay or fire someone because they identify as transgender. That's not fair. But at the same time, I don't think small Christian schools should be forced to hire people who aren't Christian and flout Christian beliefs. So I think a free society protects the rights of bona fide religious organizations to live according to their faith, but binds secular large businesses and mid to large size corporations with fair anti-discrimination laws. So that's what this bill does, in that it defines anything as a public accommodation with 15 or more employees. So that means you can't discriminate against gay and transgender people in restaurants, hotels, entertainment, medical services, and all sorts of medium to large retailers, but it does mean that the small cake maker who's a Christian, who has one employee, you can't go and force him to bend the knee and participate in your wedding. So it does, I think, strike the balance really well between what most reasonable people would see as a fair balance between LGBT rights and religious liberty. And that's why the bill is called Fairness for All.
And part of the Fairness for All also extends to individuals in the medical field who don't want to be a part of procedures such as abortion that violates their religious beliefs.
Yes. Conservatives, myself included, agree that people have conscious rights, and that includes to those in the medical sphere. So I don't think any doctor should be forced to provide a service that violates their conscience, whether it's an abortion or whether it's, say, hormone treatments for transgender patients. But I also don't think that in a fair society, medical professionals can turn you away for vaccines or normal treatments just because of who you are or who you love. I think that's not fair either. So this bill strikes a very fair compromise. Basically, a medical doctor can choose what services they're going to provide, so they can say, sorry, I don't do sex changes, I don't do hormone treatments, as long as they apply that equally. So they can't give the treatments out to some people and not to others, but they're perfectly allowed to hold their medical practice and just not perform those particular services that violate their conscience. So that's the way that I think you, under this legislation, can enshrine fair rights under law and access without trampling over the rights of doctors. So that's just one example, but this bill takes a reasonable, balanced approach to adoption agencies, to employment, to housing. It takes this, obviously, you know, the bill's 84 pages or whatever. You can't explain every single provision in a column or a radio interview, but basically in every situation, it tries to find a reasonable middle ground. And that's why I think it's something conservatives should support.
Just joining me, I'm talking with Brad Palumbo. He's a deputy editor over at the Washington Examiner. You should check out his piece on the Fairness for All bill. It's at WashingtonExaminer.com. Also on Twitter, follow Brad at Brad_Palumbo. You know, you and I might look at this bill and say, yes, this is very reasonable. I'm all on board. It strikes a good balance between both sides. You and I also both know that there's going to be the LGBTQ side that will still not be happy with this, at least as it's defined by the progressive activists.
Yeah, no, they won't be, and that's truly a shame. You know, the Human Rights Campaign, a supposed LGBT rights group, but it's actually just a Democratic Party front group, if we're being honest, they came out and bashed this legislation. They said that it's a disgrace, it's a dangerous bill. Like, hold on. These gay rights advocates, so-called, bashed the first ever LGBT rights bill to get support from conservative Republicans. That is not reasonable. That is partisan, and that is sinister, frankly. So obviously, I agree with you. The crazy left-wing LGBT activists are not going to be on board with this legislation, but that doesn't change the fact that at the end of the day, it's still the right thing to do.
But doesn't that just essentially make this all symbolic coming from the representative?
Yes and no. You know, I don't think this particular bill is going to pass as it is now, but it does actually put a very important concrete policy out there, because right now the only bill we have passed in Congress is the Equality Act. So I do believe that eventually in the next 10 years, some form of LGBT rights bill will pass Congress and be signed into law by the president. So by putting in this balanced alternative into the mix, hopefully most or many of the provisions from it will make their way into whatever ultimate bill is signed into law.
And that's really what this is about from my perspective as well. I mean, you know, you have one side that will pass a bill and then they'll say the other side, they don't even have anything on the table that they want us to discuss. Okay, well, here's something on the table that we'd like to discuss. The fact of the matter is, if the folks on the left wanted to pass some very reasonable accommodations and reasonable laws, they could just do a standalone bill that doesn't include all of this other garbage that they want to push into it because they've been told to do so by hardcore progressive activists. It's the same thing we see with gun rights. They have H.R. 8, which they want to pretend is just a universal background check law. No, it's not at all. In fact, if it was just a standalone universal background check law, it probably would pass. But they push all of this other stuff that has ultimately nothing to do with the main objections from reasonable people.
They do, and I think that tells you something about their motivations. Because if their goal was actually to do whatever it takes to get protections for LGBT people or to get reasonable gun laws into law, they would go along and compromise and offer reasonable solutions. However, if your goal is to get reelected, you don't actually want these issues to be solved, because then they go away and they stop motivating your base. So I think part of the reason that you might not see any Democratic legislators support this eminently reasonable law is that if they don't have the LGBT wedge issue to wax poetic about on the campaign trail, then maybe LGBT people won't feel like they have to vote for them. Many already don't feel like they have to vote for the Democrats. That could happen even more. So I think part of the Democratic Party and the progressive activist wing's opposition to bills like this, and the reason they put poison pills in their own legislation, is because they don't want the problem solved, because those problems help them come election time.
WashingtonExaminer.com. Go there now. Check out Brad Palumbo's latest column and follow him on Twitter. Brad_Palumbo, P-O-L-U-M-B-O on Twitter. Brad, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason.
Absolutely. You're listening to the Jason Rancho. To the Jason Rancho on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. The much-anticipated Inspector General's report is out, and it cites a number of substantial inaccuracies and omissions in the FBI's FISA warrants against Carter Page, a warrant that allowed Obama's FBI to spy on a presidential campaign and an American citizen. However, it does not find that the probe was motivated by politics, a position that Attorney General Bill Barr takes issue with. Joining me to discuss all of this is Ash Scow. She's a reporter with The Daily Wire. Ash, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back. Always love to be here.
So, pretty damning report. It lays out 17 inaccuracies and omissions. You posted a pretty lengthy piece going through all of them. What are some of the omissions or lies that stood out to you?
Well, there's a number of them because they pretty much all 17, with the exception of a few, relate to how Carter Page, who is a Trump campaign aide, he was fairly low level, but he's kind of become like the central, right? He was kind of like the central focus for this whole investigation, mm-hmm. that it was allegedly his contacts with Russia were, you know, the kind of the catalyst for all of this, along with George Papadopoulos, who was also another low-level aide, along with comments he allegedly made. So most of the inaccuracies and omissions relate to either Carter Page or Christopher Steele. If you recall, Christopher Steele was the one who compiled the Steele dossier, which was this big, salacious document that allegedly said, you know, Trump, that Russia had compromising information on Trump, that they could use to blackmail him, and all of this stuff. So many of these relate to those two people specifically. I mean, a lot of the omissions, the big omissions, are that the FBI left out in its first FISA application and then its three renewals, even after it got information, was specifically told information that contradicted what was in the applications. It did not change it, including information that Page had previously provided information to a government agency concerning his prior contacts with certain Russian intelligence officers. Information like that was omitted. So you know, the government knew about Page's conduct because he worked mm-hmm. with the government regarding those contacts, and that was left out of the FISA report or the applications. And as relating to Christopher Steele, a lot of information about his role, his previous role in investigations with the FBI. I mean, they basically pumped him up saying that his previous reporting had been corroborated and used in criminal proceedings, when in reality it was like minimally corroborated and wasn't like really that big. And they also omitted information that Christopher Steele was kind of sloppy at his job. He wasn't a high-ranking official. He was like middle management, mm-hmm. and that he wasn't very good at his job. Now, I had a story earlier this year that his former boss, the head of MI6 at the time that Steele was there working on Russia stuff, refused to answer a reporter's question about what Steele was like as an employee. He just walked away, like pretty much shaking his head, like wouldn't even say, because Steele was not really good at his job. But the FBI left that out and instead pumped him up like he was some, you know, like he was the source. He's just unimpeachable.
Well, what's interesting about all of this is, of course, this dossier was used by the Democrats to try to defeat Donald Trump. And the FBI used this, including large portions that were completely false. They were either falsified or just blatantly incorrect, to justify them going after President Obama's political adversary.
Right, exactly. And yeah, you have Democrats have been saying the Steele dossier, that didn't play a role or much of a role in the FISA application. And yet here we have this IG report that was like, oh yeah, it was pretty much the only thing that was in there. It was basically everything they relied on. And they did not clearly put out there that it was a political campaign document paid for by the DNC and Hillary Clinton's campaign. I mean, that was really, really not put out there to the FISA court. So, I mean, you've just got all of this information in this IG that is saying all of the wrongdoing, all of the political targeting, everything they left out in order to get what they wanted. But because there was nobody said, oh yeah, we're politically biased against Trump, and there was no documentation of them saying that, even though, I mean, there was the stroke text, you know, but because of that, like, oh, it wasn't motivated by political bias. And like, I can understand how he could come to that conclusion, but it's like the inference is just so either he saw all of that and was like, well, there's nothing in writing that they did it because of this, but you could clearly infer from what they did that this was to go against Trump. Or this kind of scarier conclusion is that things like this happen all the time in FBI FISA warrant applications. And so who knows how many people have been unfairly targeted.
Oh, it's no big deal.
Omissions and inaccuracies. Yeah,
not a big deal at all. By the way, we're talking with Ash Gow from The Daily Wire. You can read her piece on this at dailywire.com. We only have about 2 minutes left. I want to talk a little bit about how Attorney General Bill Barr reacted. He put out a statement that includes the Inspector General's report now makes clear that the FBI launched an intrusive investigation of a U.S. presidential campaign on the thinnest of suspicions. He generally rejects parts of this report that claim that there was no political bias. Was this a claim of they just weren't able to prove without a shadow of a doubt that there was any actual bias here politically, or is it that the evidence suggests the opposite?
Well, I think that, like, in a very narrow set of terms, they might not have had the evidence. But, I mean, I just don't understand how you can read this report, read how much was ignored, how much was the fact that somebody even doctored an email to make it look like, you know, the Steele dossier wasn't used, you know, like that they were actually doctoring evidence in this, that it's kind of hard to say that it wasn't politically motivated when it happened in an election year under President Obama. Pro-Hillary people were doing, you know, like it's difficult, but it's like, okay, fine. They don't have the text messages from people saying like, okay, we are going to do this, this, and this to get Trump, you know?
Yeah, it's very interesting when you put this across some of the questioning today during the impeachment hearing where Jerry Nadler says, well, of course, the guy who was breaking the law didn't put in a text message. Here it is. I'm going to break the law. Here's the quid pro quo. But that exact same argument they're accepting when it comes to this Inspector General's report. Now, this story is not over. There's going to be another investigation as a result of the findings here. Once we get that data, of course, we'll put it out there. We've been talking with Ash Gow from Daily Wire at dailywire.com. Ash, my friend, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me back.
Of course. You're listening to The Jason Rancho.